Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 16, 2014, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. Today, our teleform is on Operation Choke Point. What is it? What is it all about? I'm Dean Reuter, the Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to have with us today three experts, some of whom are return guests to Teleform, so special thanks to them. We're going to hear in order from Professor Todd J. Zawicki. He's the Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. He's going to give us some background on exactly what Operation Choke Point is. Then we'll hear next from Mr. Ian Murray. He's the Vice President for Strategy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And then finally, we'll get opening remarks from Charles J. Chuck Cooper. He's a partner at Cooper & Kirk here in Washington, D.C. We'll get opening remarks from each of about 6 to 10 minutes, then some back and forth between and among them. And then, as always, we'll be turning to you for your questions, so please do be ready with your audience questions. And with that, Professor Zawicki, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks, everybody, for tuning in for this. This is a rapidly developing story. And one of the things, we're fortunate to have Chuck Cooper and Ian Murray with us today. One of the things that's interesting about Operation Choke Point is it's been really very secretive and very difficult to get information about both what the government is trying to do and what they are actually doing here. So I'm going to spend a few minutes just sort of providing the background about what's going on and what we know about it, while acknowledging at the same time that this has been really kind of difficult to get information about, cloaked in secrecy. It's involved things like reporters finding documents left behind for meetings and all kind of things like this. But what I would do is take a minute and just explain what the government claims that they're doing with Operation Choke Point, and then talk about what is suggested that it looks like maybe the government is doing more than it claims it's doing. What the government claims it's doing is trying to crack down on fraudulent payments, basically, using third-party payment processors such as banks and the like to, as they say, choke off the air to certain businesses that in industries that the government thinks are unusually prone to fraud. So, for instance, they've got a long list that they originally pointed out. It's sort of some of these things are not like the other sort of list. Some of them are they've got tobacco sales on the list. They've got things that are could be illegal, escort services, drug paraphernalia, fireworks, that sort of thing. They've got things that are just sort of dubious, like get-rich products, government grants, that sort of thing. And then they've got some products that are perfectly legal products, such as payday lending, or things such as, one of the examples they give is racist materials, which is, of course, perfectly legal, protected by the First Amendment, but for some reason is on this list with things like illegal Viagra sales and online gambling and the like. And so there's this kind of question about what's going on here. The government claims that what they're trying to do is basically police online fraud, primarily online, by regulating the payment processors. And so basically what they claim is the core project is that they're looking around for industries or companies within the industries that have a lot of disallowed payments. Now, this in and of itself is not problematic inherently. The Federal Trade Commission, for instance, has done this for a long time, where they will look at merchants or companies who have a lot of disallowed payments, chargebacks from their third-party payment providers, and in theory, often that can be an indicia of a fraudulent enterprise, of people making fraudulent charges to credit cards and that sort of thing. But it's not necessarily the case, as Chuck Cooper will, I'm sure, talk about later. The fact that payments could be disallowed not because they're fraudulent, but because the guy might not have any money the first time it's put through, such as with a payday lender. But that's what they claim that they're doing. Now, what we see in practice, though, according to some of the allegations we've read about from parties, is broader than that, which is what the allegation has been, is that Operation Choke Point is not just choking off the air to fraudulent companies or fraudulent industries, but there's been reports that it's doing a lot more. So, for instance, there are firearms sales companies that claim that their banks have told them that they will no longer provide banking services for them because they sell firearms, and that they're getting pressure from the government to shut those off. There are people who are involved in the pornography industry, such as performers, who have claimed that their bank has told them that they would no longer provide banking services to them because they are too risky. And as Chuck Cooper will talk about in some detail, payday lenders have made the same claim. Now, what seems to be the fallback position of the government is this notion of reputational risk, which is that dealing with firearms companies, dealing with pornography performers, that sort of thing, makes the bank look bad. And so as a result, they can shut off banking services to those people, even though they're engaged in legal enterprises. So why does it matter to figure out what's going on here? If you just go by what the government is saying that they're doing, basically what they claim that they're doing is protecting consumers by protecting them from getting ripped off by fraudulent sellers and purveyors of improper products and the like. As I'm sure Ian will talk about in some detail, there's an indifference at best about their ability to the ability of legitimate businesses, legal businesses, and the impact that it might have on these companies. But what they claim is that they're just using a good leverage point in order to prevent illegal activity. Now, there is some irony in that at the same time that they're running Operation Choke Point, the government is also pressuring sellers of illegal marijuana products, which are, of course, illegal still under federal law, to start accepting payments from pot sellers. So there is some irony in that particular aspect of it. But that's the first part, which is the first part is that it matters because even though they claim they're targeting illegal businesses, it looks like, and there's allegations that they're spilling over to legal businesses. And you could obviously see where that might lead. If they're targeting firearm sales, for instance, it seems, potentially that, a different administration could target abortion clinics, for instance. Why would it be, for instance, that it presents reputational risk to be banking a company that sells guns, but not to be banking an abortion clinic, for instance, which would seem to be at least as controversial? The second reason why it matters relates to a larger trend that we've seen, which is this government turning banks and private companies into arms of the federal government in order to enforce the law. So we saw this originally with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where they've basically commandeered banks to police the lending practices of auto dealers against discrimination. Here, what we see seems to be the same sort of thing, which is using the leverage of the government to turn third parties into arms of the federal government. If the allegations are true. And that's obviously very problematic, which is that they're basically, if it's true, as we'll hear more about, that they're shutting off funds to legal industries, then they're doing it without any sort of rulemaking, without any sort of formal enforcement. It's just using their leverage to shut it off. And that is a very problematic development that we're seeing here, not just here, but elsewhere. With those introductory remarks, I'll turn it over to Ian, who is at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and has been working on a report on all the ins and outs of Operation Choke Point.
Thank you very much, Todd, for that very helpful introduction. I should begin by saying that I am not a lawyer, which I think is important in this. But I am a former civil servant. I'm a former civil servant in the British Department of Transport, as you might guess from my accent. And therefore, I have certain expectations of the standards that civil servants should use in applying their using their powers, the powers granted them by Congress, and in this case, and in this case, I have to say that this appears to be a very clear overstep of what is appropriate behavior for civil servants. If we look at the genesis of Operation Choke Point, first of all, there was the guidance from FIDIC in 2011, which contains that list of high risk activities that Todd was talking about. And then in February 2012, basically one U.S. attorney who'd been prosecuting a quite clearly fraudulent third-party payment processor that had basically been channeling payments for the online gambling industry. If you remember the takedown of the online poker industry in 2011, one of the main ways that this was proved to be wire fraud, or alleged to be wire fraud at the time, was because of the use of this third-party payment processor. And this third-party payment processor had not just channeled money from the gambling industry, pretending it was something else, but had also been involved in defrauding lots of elderly people out of money via their process payment system. And the reason that this came to this particular attorney's attention was because of a very, very high rate of return, over 50%. In other words, over 50% of the payments that this processor asked banks for were challenged by the customer, the original bank holder, bank account holder. And so he approached the Consumer Protection Working Group of the Financial Fraud Enforcement Task Force that was established by the Department of Justice, saying, look, I think there's lots more fraud going on with these third-party payment processors, and we can choke off, use the terms explicitly, choke off the oxygen to the fraudulent merchants that are using them if we target these people, these processors. And so that's where this came from. Initially, they were looking primarily at online, in particular, online payday lending. Although later on that broadened out to all sorts of payday lending. As you look through the various documents that the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee obtained from the Department of Justice about Operation Choke Point, you can see that there is a crusading zeal amongst these the officials and the attorneys that were working for the Department of Justice on this. They clearly believed that the fraud was rampant amongst third-party payment processors, that a return rate of 3% was a good signal for fraud, not the 50% that Joel Sweet had seen in that initial case, but 3%. And as a result, they served subpoenas on over 50 companies in the first 6 months of 50 banks in the first 6 months of operation. And by the six-month status report, which was on September 9th, 2013, they were celebrating the fact that, and I'll quote here, segments of the banking industry that have been doing business with third-party payment processors have chosen to exit or severely curtail that business, thereby making it harder and in some cases impossible for untold numbers of merchants who prey on consumers to run their legitimate operations. The report said that we consider this to be a significant accomplishment. Now, at about this time, they did start looking at whether their operations were also deterring banks from dealing with legitimate lenders. They did recognize that possibility, but they believed that their argument was that solving that problem should be left to legitimate lenders themselves, who, and I quote, through their own dealings with banks, present sufficient information to the banks to convince them that their business model and lending operations are wholly legitimate. Now, of course, once we're getting into these circumstances where people have to prove their innocence to banks that are coming under regulatory enhanced regulatory supervision, as soon as that happens, you know what the actual result is going to be. There is going to be a chilling effect, and that certainly seems to be what's happened. The Operation Choke Point clearly talked about reputational risk and made reference to the FIDIC guidance from 2011. And banks, it seems, quite clearly connected the two quite separate, originally quite separate ideas, and said, well, if they're coming after payday lenders who are on that high-risk reputational reputational list from FIDIC, then they'll probably come after the others. And so, you know, it looks like they started closing off accounts for particularly gun dealers and, as Todd said, performers in the pornography industry. So what I think we're seeing here, there's a combination of problems, and some of them Todd has already mentioned. I mean, the first is that this is basically overzealous pursuit of fraud by federal officials. I mean, these officials have been granted significant powers that they may exercise in the public interest, and it's therefore incumbent on them, as far as I'm concerned, for them to be particularly circumspect about the use of those powers. At all points in the decision-making process of the Department of Justice, then there should be feedback loops in place to ask whether the continuing action is inappropriate. The internal DOJ memos and reports clearly show that questions were raised that should have caused them pause as to whether they should continue with these actions. But these were repeatedly dismissed as detrimental to the mission of going after the genuine fraudsters. There's also a self-fulfilling prophecy element to it, and this particularly comes into account when you take into account the return rate of 3% or above as being the marker for fraud. As Todd mentioned, you know, this does not take into account the individual circumstances of the individual industry. For instance, payday lenders are often dealing with people who have very little money, and so they may the reason for the chargeback, the reason for the return rate, is not because people were being defrauded and challenging it, but because they simply didn't have the funds available to pay what they promised. Similarly, in pornography, there is a quite well-known shame effect that people get caught by their spouse, for instance, having subscribed to a website, and then they say, oh, no, it must have been hacked, or that was fraud, or something. And so, again, there's a naturally high rate of return there. I have been unable to find out why there should be a high rate of return in the guns or firearms industry, but I'm continuing to look into that. There's a chilling effect. As I mentioned earlier, you know, banks around the country are already very highly regulated and are having to, especially small and medium-sized banks, are having to merge in order to deal with the extra compliance costs that were brought about as a result of Dodd-Frank and other financial regulation. So if you're facing extra supervision, then you're probably just going to try and cut off any dealings with people that might cause that extra regulation, that extra supervision. So the easy way out is just to drop payment processes and high-risk clients altogether. And at no point do any of the internal DOJ memos or reports even consider this chilling effect, nor do they even consider the effect on the customer of these otherwise legitimate industries. In the case of payday lenders, you know, customers are often unbanked and have no viable credit rating. So if they're not able to use a payday lender because of Operation Choke Point, they will probably seek out wholly illegal loan sources, and that can't be good for the customer. That is not looked at anywhere in the DOJ report. Todd's already mentioned the inappropriate deputizing of banks as essentially guardians of basically doing the DOJ's job for them. There's constitutional implications, obviously, with free speech for industries like pornography, and as Todd also mentioned, there's the possible effect of precedent. What could another administration do with this? And I think in all of these cases, the answer is the same. The Department of Justice has allowed itself to just to get overtaken by a zealous pursuit of fraud, and it's not taking into account all the negative implications of what it's doing. And that is a failure of management of the Department of Justice, and really the only solution for that is for the administration itself to clean house, possibly to start an investigation by the Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Justice to find out what exactly is going on there and what went wrong. And with that, I will turn over to Chuck Cooper, who will have some very useful indications of the effects on the customers themselves.
Well, yes, thank you, Ian, for that. And the first thing I'd like to do is thank Dean Reuter and the Federalist Society for organizing this teleconference, and just say that I appreciate very much being invited to join Todd Zawicki and Ian Murray in discussing this important subject matter. The reason I'm involved in this call is because, unlike Ian, I am a lawyer, and I have actually brought a lawsuit challenging Operation Choke Point insofar as it has been targeted at the payday lending industry. I represent two clients, the Community Financial Services Association, which is a national trade association for community lenders. And it and its members serve millions, literally millions of consumers in more than 30 states, offering a range of financial services, primarily including short-term, small-dollar loans that are commonly known as payday loans. The other client is called Advance America, which is a major payday lender and provides other financial services as well, of course, but payday lending is one of them, and it's a major member of the association itself. We've brought a lengthy complaint, about 40 pages long, but I think our claims are quite straightforward. The essence of our claim is that the banking regulatory agencies, and by the way, our lawsuit is against the three principal banking regulatory agencies because they do provide the prudential regulatory oversight for the banks that, insofar as we've been able to identify, have yielded to this Operation Choke Point and have severed relationships with payday lenders, many of them severing relationships, all banking ties, with the payday lending industry as a whole. We are aware of over 80 banks that have completely cut off the banking relationships of payday lenders. And these payday lending relationships have been longstanding, mutually beneficial, positive relationships. The banks have told our members, that is the members of the CFSA, that the problem isn't with them. There's no concern about the nature of the relationship. There are no concerns about these particular customers being engaged in any improper conduct. They are regarded and known to be law-abiding, responsible members of the payday lending industry. And in fact, a condition of membership in CFSA is to be licensed properly in every state that you're serving in, serving customers in, to adhere to all state and federal regulations, and more importantly even, to abide by a code of best practices that has been established and is self-imposed on the members of this industry. So by definition, the members of the industry that belong to the association, such as Advance America, are not the fraudsters. And yet they, along with the industry as a whole, are being grievously injured by this entire process. And it's come about as a result of an active and concerted regulatory campaign, we allege and we believe, to drive the payday lending industry out of business. They're doing it, as both Todd and Ian has mentioned, by attempting to choke off the oxygen, the financial services oxygen necessary for this industry and really any industry to survive. To choke them off by a variety of backroom regulatory pressure tactics, things such as pressuring the banks that if they continue to do business with these disfavored industries, and it's not just the payday industry, but it is especially targeted at the payday industry. If they continue to do business with customers in these industries, they can expect harshly difficult and prolonged examinations. They can expect audits. They can expect examination report their report ratings to go down, and other such techniques as that. And the fulcrum for that regulatory campaign, backroom pressure tactics, is this nebulous and highly subjective concept called reputation risk. You've heard both Todd and Ian mention this concept, and it is contained in no regulation submitted to notice and comment. Rather, it's contained in some informal guidance documents. And it's described, believe it or not, as the risk arising, and I'm quoting, the risk arising from negative public opinion, end quote. And in this single informal document where reputation risk is described, the banking industry is made aware that it is a regulatory criterion that the regulators are going to apply, it is described again as any risk arising from negative public opinion, and they go further and say it can result from any negative publicity involving the bank's customers, and it's just really very hard to think of any more subjective, vaguer notion or that is more fraught with potential for abuse and manipulation against industries that are simply disfavored by the administration. Todd mentioned that future administrations may dislike other activities that this one favors. For example, the marijuana industry. At the same time that the Obama administration's banking regulators are trying to choke off the payday lending industry, the firearm sales industry, ammunition, fireworks, coin dealers, dating services, pharmaceutical sales online, a range of perfectly legitimate businesses. At the same time, they're trying to choke off the financial oxygen to those businesses, they're doing everything they can to promote and to provide financial services to the marijuana industry. So the potential for, and we believe the reality of active political bias in regulatory enforcement this notion of reputation risk is simply pregnant with potential for that. And we believe that the ways in which the banking regulatory agencies are proceeding violates the rule of law in a number of ways. And in particular, we think it violates the Administrative Procedure Act. And in every way you can violate the Administrative Procedure Act, and I'll come back in a moment to that, but also violates the basic due process requirements of the Fifth Amendment. First of all, the banking regulators simply have no statutory authority to try, as they are now doing, to eliminate the payday loan industry. They simply don't have authority to enforce such an inherently and subjective and manipulable standard as this notion of regulatory risk. Our point on this is that this type of limitless and manipulable discretionary lawmaking standard is simply not something that Congress can delegate to the banking regulators. There's a Supreme Court case law making clear that the banking regulatory agencies, and the reason broad delegations are possible to banking regulatory agencies is because they are limited by customary banking and banking regulatory practices and standards. And this new reputation risk simply can't be brought within that broad focus. Secondly, and I think even more importantly, is this vague, subjective notion of reputation risk cannot be applied to legitimate industries as a binding regulatory norm unless and until it is subjected to the proper procedural requirements of the APA, that is simply notice and comment rulemaking. This reputation risk is being enforced as a binding norm. By operation of Operation Choke Point, it's visiting grievous harm and threatens to very possibly choke off entirely the payday loan industry. And regulations of that binding nature must be subjected to notice and comment rulemaking. And the very purpose of that regularized procedural requirement is to ensure that a concept like regulatory risk is limited and channeled in ways that it becomes objective, it becomes enforceable, and the regulated entities know by virtue of black and white regulations that can be applied and that can be challenged judicially, which of course these vague guideline reputation risk notion cannot be, so that the regulatory activity comes out of the back rooms into the open and the regulated entities can know with reasonable certainty what is expected and required of them, and the regulations themselves can take care to establish standards that will draw distinctions between the fraudsters on the one hand, which everyone, including especially my clients, want to see driven from this industry as well as any industry in which they're preying on consumers, but draw a distinction between the bad apples in the industry and those law-abiding, responsible members of the industry that should not be lumped in with them. Finally, the whole approach is arbitrary and capricious, simply because it doesn't seek to draw distinctions between, notwithstanding the claims of the Department of Justice and others. It doesn't seek to, it's indifference to, whether or not the members of the payday industry that are victimized by this Operation Choke Point backroom regulatory pressure are engaged in fraud or are law-abiding, responsible members of the industry that are providing what is a very important and necessary service to millions of low-income and other consumers throughout the country. And for all these reasons, it simply violates due process. The law-abiding members of the payday loan industry are having their liberty interest in pursuing a lawful business compromised through these regulatory backroom techniques, and their reputations. They're being smeared with the same stigma that the fraudsters are and suffering the very same harms that should be focused and intended only for the fraudulent members of the industry. And so with that basic sketch, Dean, of the thrust of our complaint, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you very much, one and all. I do want to get to the audience questions, so why don't we do two things here. I'm going to open the floor to questions and then revert to Professor Zawicki to see if he can ask maybe some challenging questions of our other presenters and get his response to their remarks. But in a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to indicate that you have a question for one or more of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We do have a number of callers with questions. We've got about 25 minutes left. Before I go back to Professor Zawicki, let me ask a question quickly of Chuck Cooper. You mentioned the lawsuit. Where is that geographically and procedurally? How's that stand?
Yes. Thank you, Dean. We filed the lawsuit in the district court for the District of Columbia. It has been assigned to Judge Kessler in the district court here. And that's really all that's happened. The case was filed just a week ago or so.
Okay, very good. Professor Zawicki, do you want to add to your statements, or should we turn to the audience for questions?
I think we could turn to the audience for questions, though.
Okay, we've got four callers with questions pending. If you want to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, this is David Tryon in Cleveland. Mr. Cooper, have you sought injunctive relief?
Yes, we're seeking declaratory and injunctive relief against this concerted regulatory campaign.
So, have you done it on a TRO or a preliminary injunction?
No, we have not at this time sought any kind of preliminary relief. That remains a possibility, but we're hopeful things are going to move rapidly enough that we won't have to try to seek preliminary relief, but that remains a possibility.
Thanks. Well, we'll be watching. Good luck.
Thank you.
Chuck, real quick, Todd here, you've named as defendants in the case. If those are interested, you can find the complaint on the Community Financial Service Association of America, CFSAA.com. If you look around on the website there, you can get a copy of the complaint there. But, Chuck, you've named the FDIC, the Board of Governors, and the Comptroller of the Currency as defendants. One of the things that's confusing about this to me is it seems like that, and maybe Ian, you may have an answer too, it seems like the DOJ is involved in this, perhaps the FTC is involved, the CFPB is involved. Is there a reason why you picked the defendants you picked at this particular stage, and What's your sense about what the role of maybe some of these other agencies are, as far as you can tell?
Yeah. Todd, we have filed this suit against the banking regulatory agencies because they are the prudential regulators of the banks. They are the front line, and we believe the central players in what we think and what we have the evidence to demonstrate is this backroom regulatory pressure. As I mentioned earlier, many, if not most, of our members who have had banking terminations thus far have, number one, the banks have identified regulatory pressure oftentimes in writing, but consistently in their dialogue with our members, and they've made very clear that they themselves are not at all dissatisfied with the banking relationship. It's been mutually beneficial, profitable, on both sides, positive, and they don't have any suspicions or concern that our members are engaged in fraudulent behavior or anything else that is wrongful or improper. But they're nonetheless severing the relationship because of regulatory pressure. We think that if the regulators are required to do what the APA clearly requires of them, which is submit this type of regulatory norm, if they're going to insist on applying it, this reputational risk, and if they are required to submit it to notice and comment, we're quite sure that that process will lead to objective standards and criteria that is aimed at weeding the fraudsters out of the industry, which we applaud and which we welcome, but is also tailored to ensure that this perfectly lawful business can continue to have productive banking relationships with the national banking institutions. So that's the focus of our lawsuit. As it continues to unfold and we litigate it, we may learn more that leads us to seek to to amend, to identify other defendants. But right now, it's the prudential regulators of the banks that have severed the relationships that we're focused on.
If I may add one quick thing, I think one very interesting thing that comes out of the Department of Justice documents is that the Consumer Federal the Consumer Financial Protection Board is part of the Consumer Protection Working Group that helped set up Operation Choke Point right at the beginning. But as I'm sure many people are aware, the Dodd-Frank Act gives a power to regulate the payday lending industry and a very constricted power to regulate the payday lending industry to the CFPB. Very early on in Operation Choke Point, CFPB appears to have dropped out of it. In fact, there's one point they complain that CFPB isn't actually returning any phone calls or emails on payday lending. So there may be an untold turf dispute here as well that I think we need to get to the bottom of.
Well, and Ian, you make a very important point here about the regulatory authority at issue. It is the CFPB that has regulatory authority over these types of consumer protection, as its name would imply, consumer protection considerations, which are allegedly at the heart of Operation Choke Point. Depending on what it does, it could presumably engage in notice and comment rulemaking that was proper and provided kind of objective standards for imposing this reputation risk that the other banking regulators could abide by themselves or could imitate. So there's a lot of ways that this we think this problem can be solved in a proper and legal way. But thanks for making that point about authority.
Why don't we go to another question, Dean?
Let me interject really quickly and ask Chuck Cooper. Would you concede that the agencies have the authority to regulate, to sort of steer banking away from a business model as high risk if they go through the Administrative Procedure Act, if they follow those procedures? Can they sort of indicate that an entire industry is high risk?
No, I would not concede that. What I would concede is that a risk that is directly related to unlawful conduct, to fraudulent conduct, is a risk that the banking regulators can quite properly seek to ensure that the banks themselves are adequately supervising, adequately protecting themselves and therefore their other depositors against. But that's a very different thing. And that, I guess, can be tethered to this notion of reputation risk, although I don't believe it has to be. But we would not at all concede that a perfectly legitimate business can, even through notice and comment rulemaking, be effectively eliminated. That seems to us like something only Congress can do.
And Dean, one of the things that's concerning here is, as Ian described the history of this, you could use what appears to be payment fraud as a way of smoking out fraudulent transfers. But once you start looking at gun companies or pornography performers, there's no reason to believe that those people are, I don't think there's any allegation that these legitimate gun dealers, licensed, regulated like heck, are, returning payments and processing fraudulent payments like crazy. And so that's where the line goes from what seemed to have been, a plausible idea of using this as a way of identifying fraud against consumers, to turning it on its head, as Chuck Cooper's describing, basically using it as a way to essentially outlaw legitimate businesses under this vague claim of reputation risk. And that's where then the safety and soundness regulators get into the act and basically start pressuring them, basically saying, well, the fact that you're banking gun dealers is a reputation risk to you, and so that presents a safety and soundness problem. So it's really quite a profound and subjective overreach compared to the original germ of the idea that they seem to start with.
All right, let's take another question from our audience.
Hi, Alden Abbott. Quick question. What about takings overtones, Fifth Amendment takings? In effect, although there may be serious legal problems, in effect, isn't the government to the extent it is indirectly eliminating the property interests of legitimate companies, that's a serious deprivation of their property rights?
This is Chuck Alden. Nice to hear your voice. And of course, Alden is a recognized expert in that field. Alden, I think there's a lot to the point you're making. Our focus is to not really to seek at this stage anyway to obtain any kind of compensation, just compensation for the valuable banking relationships that have been lost or anything such as that, but rather to halt this process, this regulatory campaign, and insist that the law's requirements for regulatory action of this kind be followed. We think that if they are, that my clients, the members of the Community Financial Services Association, and other law-abiding, responsible lending entities, will have nothing to fear from banking regulators and the imposition of proper banking regulators on the financial institutions that are truly the lifeblood of this industry and of any industry.
Ian Murray, anything on this point?
CEI is obviously always very concerned about any form of regulatory taking. I suspect it would be much more difficult, given the problems that we have in proving takings in something as obvious as the environmental field. I suspect it would be more difficult to prove it here. But clearly, the actual value of the takings is immense. When you take into account how many industries could potentially be targeted here, so that's something that we will be looking at in our report.
So. Yeah, I agree. As a legal matter, I guess just my point was as sort of a rhetorical matter, the real economic impact, a tangible economic impact, and is always good to highlight for a broad audience.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to emphasize Ian's last point, which I just think how broadly this can sweep. I mean, one of the things that's on the list is racist materials,
yep.
Right? And we're talking about now we're getting into pretty serious subjective kind of assessments about what's what's a bad industry and what's a good industry without any serious effort to link it to any coherent consumer protection rationale.
Well, let's take another question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Members of the forum should be aware that this Operation Choke Point is only one prong of a broad front of similar exercises of what may be Cass Sunstein's policy of nudging behavior. Remember that many of the institutions subject to regulation tend to overcomply. For example, you can no longer open a bank account without providing a Social Security number. But the Patriot Act or regulations under it do not require banks to demand Social Security numbers. They only say that those are acceptable ways of identifying oneself. And yet the banks overcomply anyway. So you could win your lawsuit and still not accomplish your purpose if, as long as the subjects of regulation are willing to overcomply beyond all reason. And
yeah.
So you're up against a much larger problem, and you won't solve it by representing one industry at a time. Because they'll just pick you off one at a time. This needs to be a broad front and coordinated, choosing good defendants or plaintiffs in this case to push back on every prong of that front. If you don't do that, you'll just be picked off. So it's also important not to abandon the proper constitutional arguments that there is no. Absolutely no constitutional authority, as the Constitution was originally understood, to have any regulation whatsoever of services or financial transactions. And there is no authority to regulate fraud. None
Who
whatsoever.
Who wants to respond? Okay, great. Thank you for that. Who wants to respond to that?
Well, I won't. This is Todd. I won't respond to the specifics, but I think John, you make a very, very good point, and we heard it both from Ian and Chuck, which is the attitude of the enforcers here, whether they're the banking regulators or the DOJ or whatever, is this isn't a very worthwhile industry anyway. So what's the big deal if we make the legitimate people prove that they're legitimate, right? And that just cannot be. The answer, and it's for the reason that you suggest and that they suggest, which is if you're a bank, I mean, one of the problems we've had is for a long time is this entanglement of the banking system with the political system, and it's only gotten worse than in the past few years. And the powers that be in Washington understand this cozy relationship that we often see now between the big banks and the big regulators. And all they have to do is kind of, you know, give the signal, the nudge-nudge, wink-wink, look, you know, these payday lenders, they're really not contributing much to your bottom line anyway. We don't like them. Nobody else likes them. So what's the big deal if you just cut them loose, right? They're, you know, what a lot of these guys have in, if it's the firearms dealer who was with the bank for 20 years and all of a sudden basically gets cut off, what's the big deal, right? I mean, what they're doing is they're picking off very small actors and making examples of them, basically on the ground that the loss to the bank is very small financially. And that's where the danger comes in here, is that that's what the chilling effect is, which is that basically all you have to do is signal, look, we don't like these guys, and the banks get the message. And you can just replicate that down the line, because a lot of these guys are not, you know, these aren't huge contributors to the bottom line of these banks, and so they're easy for the regulators and the banks that service them to toss them overboard.
Yeah, I'd add, you know, when John talks about, you know, they can pick you off one at a time, he's absolutely right. We've already seen an example of that. Yeah, you know, I mentioned briefly what happened to online poker. It's actually very, very similar to Operation Choke Point. Basically, it all came about from debt collection problems for online poker. That inspired a new law that targeted payment processors, the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act of 2006. Regulators had applied things like the Wire Act and so on very broadly, even in defiance of court rulings. So this made banks very wary of doing business with the payment processors that dealt with poker. And so they, in the end, turned to less than legal means to keep their lifeblood going, and got destroyed as a result. So, you know, we've already seen one example of an entirely legal industry nationally being taken down by similar means, and you know, that I think is the method they're following here.
Let's try to get this final question in if we could.
This is Matt McReynolds, Pacific Justice Institute. Something that caught my attention in the Teleform announcement was a secondary negative effect on home-based charities, and I'm wondering if somebody could comment quickly on what that specific threat is from Operation Choke Point.
Well, I think it's that home-based charities are one of the industries that are regarded as high risk by FIDIC, and I presume that's because of a high return rate or something. We don't actually have any specifics of home-based charities being gone after or had their bank accounts severed yet. Perhaps Chuck might know more than I do about that. But it was only recently that all the gun groups, all the gun shops came out and told us what was happening. So it may be that this is actually happening and people haven't yet connected the dots, which is one of the reasons why we need to get the word about Operation Choke Point out to anybody who deals with any of these industries.
Yeah, that's a good point. Again, this is why, as I mentioned at the outset, this is really shrouded in secrecy, which is, as Ian just alluded to, and I don't want to lose that point, which is that there could be people who have lost banking services and they don't know why. You know, we've got one of the things that's very valuable about Chuck's complaint, and I really recommend everybody who's interested in this to read this, because he's got a lot of, you know, sworn facts and statements about what particular payday lending companies have been told by various banks, you know, and it could be a lot of these situations are just situations where somebody all of a sudden just doesn't have a bank account anymore, and they don't tell them why, and so it could be that some of these things are happening and they just haven't connected the dots, so they don't know why or whatever the case may be. So you know, that's one of the problems about the way in which this works so much in secrecy and informally along the ways that that Chuck was describing, which is that the people themselves who are harmed may not even realize that they've been harmed by this enterprise.
Yeah, that's. I would just add that is a very good point. We see a wide variation in terms of the information that particular banks have provided, ranging from nothing other than we've decided to terminate our relationship with you, period, to we consider you in the high-risk category without any further explanation. But as I mentioned earlier, several have said we are doing this as a result of the regulatory environment, and many have provided fuller and more candid explanations and dialogue. So there's no telling how many entities out there, and it may well include home-based charities. I don't have any specific knowledge on that, I hasten to add, but it certainly may include home-based charities that have abruptly lost long-standing and positive banking relationships for no apparent reason, and it could well be traceable. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it's not traceable to this kind of regulatory pressure.
Sounds like a potential amended complaint in the future, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave things right there. And I want to thank Charles J. Cooper, Ian Murray, and Professor Todd Zawicki for your thoughts today. Certainly appreciate that. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. We're going to be discussing the proposed amendment to the First Amendment, allowing Congress to regulate speech and spending in federal elections. And then on Thursday at 12 noon Eastern Time, we'll be visiting with John Fund and Hans von Spakovsky to discuss their new book. So to our audience, check our website for updates to that. But until that next Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.